You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Geoffrey Kaufman from ABC News America. Geoffrey, what do you have for us?
Well, good morning. It's actually a really chilling story from North Korea where that young dictator Kim Jong-un has had his uncle executed.
More from Geoffrey a little later on. Also on the programme, Afghanistan and Iran talk about creating a mutual security agreement. We assess what this so-called pact of friendship could mean for the region and how much it'll irk the US.
And we rummage around the bushes in Central Park to uncover New York's tastiest homegrown morsels.
Here's the young burdock growing on the ground. The root is white inside. It's related to artichokes and smells and tastes like a combination of artichokes and potatoes.
We're talking urban foraging, of course. We'll check in with our man in Seoul, too.
All that, plus we'll flick through this morning's front pages and play some music. All to come in the next hour, here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on all the news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. North Korea's state news agency says the uncle of the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, has been executed for corruption. Earlier this week, Chang Song-taik was removed from a Communist Party meeting. The KCNA agency says he was put on trial on Thursday and admitted trying to overthrow the state. He was executed immediately. The agency said he was worse than a dog. UN investigators say chemical weapons were probably used at 5 out of 7 sites in Syria. In a report just released, they say in 2 cases the weapons targeted soldiers, in a 3rd soldiers and civilians. The report doesn't reveal whether the government or rebels used the weapons. The inspectors had already confirmed that the nerve gas sarin was used in an attack near Damascus, which killed hundreds of people in August. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon praised the investigation team.
They have carried out their tasks with the highest degree of professionalism and did so in the face of many dangers. The use of chemical weapons is a grave violation of international law and affront to our shared humanity. We need to remain vigilant to ensure that these awful weapons are eliminated, not only in Syria, but everywhere.
The leader of Ukraine's opposition Batkivshina party has called the government's promise to sign a deal with the European Union a bluff. On Thursday, the first Deputy Prime Minister, Sergei Abusov, said Kiev would soon sign a trade and association agreement with the EU, but declined to provide any date or deadline. Arseniy Yatsenyuk has dismissed his promise.
It seems to be a never-ending joke. The Ukrainian government always promises to sign an association agreement, but never met the promises. The EU is very clear, saying that the door is open and the Ukraine is, the European Union is ready to sign the AA at any time. But my feeling is that this is the bluff from the government.
The US House of Representatives has overwhelmingly passed a rare bipartisan budget plan that would end some automatic spending cuts on federal agencies known as the sequester and replace them with more targeted government savings. 169 Republicans joined 163 Democrats in voting for the plan. A new report by the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns says thousands of guns are being offered for sale illegally by unlicensed firearms dealers on a single website in the United States. The group, founded and largely funded by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, examined sales on armslist.com, a major gun trading website that enables sales in all 50 states over an 8-week period this year. The group estimated that nearly 240,000 guns would be advertised on the website in a year by high-volume sellers posing as private sellers who will not necessarily require a background check. Jewellery owned by the former British monarch Edward VIII and his American wife Wallis Simpson has sold at auction in London for just over £620,000, beating expectations. The lot featured many items that had been engraved with special inscriptions marking important milestones in the couple's lives. Souther has described Simpson, who died in 1986 at the age of 89, as the epitome of elegance and sophistication for her generation and beyond. Bryony Meredith is head of Sotheby's jewellery department.
They have incredible provenance. I mean, being owned by the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, a very famous couple, icons of the 20th century, not only for their documented relationship, but also for their very significant sense of style. And I think it's very important that not only are these beautiful, significant pieces of jewellery, but they also come attached with this love story that's been said to be one of the greatest love stories of the 20th century.
Nice work if you can get it. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney Burnham. It is 5 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, where we're setting the day's news agenda with some of the top stories over the next 24 hours. Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News America, joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the programme, Jeffrey. Let's begin with the execution of Kim Jong-un's uncle, an astonishing piece of news. We knew he'd been removed from power, but this brutal departure is something else.
Incredible. This is really an astonishing story. I guess we shouldn't be surprised by what happens in North Korea. The essence, the definition of rogue state. But this is just absolute cold-blooded brutality. That's just Kim Jong-un, the 30-year-old dictator, third generation of that family running that country since the Second World War. He took over just 2 years ago this month. And his mentor has been his uncle, his father's sister's husband, Jan Song-taek. And Jan Song-taek is the guy who really has shown him how to govern that place. Well, he's dead now. He was executed for what are a conflicting series of reasons. There's a great quote here. He was called a despicable human scum who was worse than a dog, perpetrated thrice cursed acts of treachery and betrayal of such profound trust and warmest paternal love shown by the party and the leader for him. Which I think is a convoluted way of saying that he didn't trust him anymore. There's some suggestion that it was he was plotting to overthrow his nephew.
But this is a man who was once tipped to be the supreme leader. I mean, he was going to be the place marker until Mr. Kim came of age.
Well, you know, there is a long and dishonorable tradition amongst dictators of purging the powerful nearby. I think that one of the best examples is in 1979 when Saddam Hussein was consolidating power in Iraq and 60 Baathists were summarily taken out and no one challenged Saddam after that. Kim Jong-un is proving himself to be, or is at least trying to show, that he has a tight grip on North Korea and don't mess with him. And you can be sure that the other people around him are thinking, oh my gosh, I better not step out of line.
Jan Song-taek had this position whereby he was almost a sort of foreign policy man. He went and talked to China about finance and what have you. How much is this Kim Jong-un turning around to China and actually being quite defiant and positioning himself?
It's a fair question. You know, we have to, when you talk about moderates in North Korea, you have to use that in italics and quotes.
It's a sliding scale, isn't it?
Right, exactly. But in a country that doesn't have moderates, his uncle had at least been communicating. This slams the door on communication with China. I think that North Korea always worries about becoming a puppet state of China. Quite rightly. Kim Jong-un, you'll remember, fired off a nuclear test last year to the consternation of the world, asserting his authority as an independent nation. And this is clearly part of that whole game. And just saying to the world, don't mess with me. And certainly saying to his countrymen, don't mess with me.
Is it really his authority or is it the military?
Well, I guess if the military, you know, you'd have to be inside North Korea to answer that precisely. But I think that if he controls the military, they're one and the same, aren't they? And now that he's got everyone terrified, which I think is a fair conclusion based on this cold-blooded execution, they are one and the same. So the problem is that this is a rogue state that just continues to live on. The by all measures, the largest perpetrator of human rights, prison camps, massive abuses. I think Human Rights Watch estimates 200,000 people incarcerated in absolutely brutal conditions, and a complete violation of all standards of human rights, massive poverty, starvation, while this yet the third generation of this insane family rules this country.
Let's move on to quite astonishing developments as well from the United States. After the government shutdown, I think many people had agreed that never the two sides would meet. But just quietly, Republicans and Democrats have got together and there is a bipartisan budget deal which arrives before Christmas.
Well, isn't that a nice little Christmas present for Americans? Shutdowns in Washington, at least not for more than a year. They've kicked the can down the road to 2015. It is actually quite an impressive accomplishment, especially when you consider that the Republican who negotiated this is Congressman Paul Ryan, the vice presidential candidate, who's considered a real hard right conservative. But the Republicans clearly learned from this fall's shutdown that there is nothing to be gained. They lost a lot of support. There was a lot of anger, and they were the brunt of it. They're lucky that Obamacare, the Obamacare website mess has distracted the news agenda, because until then, it promised to do real damage for them in the midterm elections on November 4th, 2014.
Jeffrey, it still has to go through the Senate, and it might be a very close vote. Who would be against it?
Well, it will be a close vote, but here's the gamesmanship in the Republican Party. There are enough, with 55 Democrats, they just need five conservatives, five Republicans, and they will get that. The problem in the Republican Party continues to be that you've got this far right Tea Party pulling it and saying, no, you know, at all costs, we've got to stop Obama and we've got to stop Obamacare. It doesn't matter what collateral damage there is. And so you've got two things going on here. One, you're going to see a lot of conservatives like Marco Rubio, a potential presidential candidate, voting against this only because he can. I mean, this is just so he can say, look, Paul Ryan supported Obama and I didn't. It's very clear that this is the luxury of knowing that your vote won't count. I think the more interesting trend here is that you're seeing House Speaker John Boehner, Paul Ryan, and a lot of mainstream but right-wing conservatives in the Republican Party really giving the middle finger to these the lobby groups on the far right who were pushing for this deal not to happen, and saying, listen, guys, you know, you are using our political agenda and our country to fundraise for your right-wing causes, and enough is enough. Mm. And so there is this outrage. These Tea Party groups are saying, this is outrageous. The Club for Growth, Heritage Action, and Americans for Prosperity are three of the biggest groups. And they're saying, what are you doing betraying Republican values? And Boehner is saying, hey, listen, this is the real world. This is not a bad deal. Go take a walk.
And what you're saying there echoes what the Financial Times is saying today, saying it lifts the cloud of political dysfunction. The picture you've just painted there is one where the margins are being pushed out and the more sensible people are actually getting together. But do you actually think that we are moving towards a less aggressive style of combat between the Republicans and the Democrats?
No. I don't think so. I think this is a case by case basis, and I think that the government shutdown this fall was such a catastrophe for the Republicans, and this is all, after all, the funding of the government. So this is on such a large scale, you can't kick this one down the road every month. So I think on this case, yes, but will this affect immigration reform, which is stalled? No. Will it affect gun control? Of course not. I think that you will see very partisan fights over nominations. So, yes, it's an optimistic, it's a nice little Christmas present. Let's just take it.
Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC, thank you very much indeed for coming on to talk to us
thank
today.
You.
Coming up, we find out why it seems the Afghans are ready to turn their backs on the Americans and towards their neighbour, Iran. Stay with us.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
AM here in London. You're listening to Midori House with Georgina Godwin and Emma Nelson. As Afghanistan comes under increasing pressure to sign the bilateral security agreement with the United States, Hamid Karzai is taking advantage of his visit to India to bolster regional cooperation. Diplomatic sources say Mr. Karzai is seeking support for a plan to establish closer ties with Pakistan, India and Iran to combat terrorism and deal with economic issues.
Earlier this week, Karzai signed a regional cooperation agreement with Iran, a clear sign the Afghans aren't going to be going running to the Americans anytime soon. Afghanistan, Pakistan specialist Samira Shackle joins us now to unpick the issues. Thank you for coming in, Samira. Now, Karzai is refusing to sign the BSA until April, until elections. But the US says that it must go ahead by the end of the year. So is the deal dead in the water?
I think it would be premature to say it's dead in the water because interestingly, as you said, the US had said it's got to be signed by the end of 2013 or we're going to pull out totally. But actually, earlier this week, you had people, US politicians saying, well, it's not such a big deal if it's in January or it's in February. So I think there's a lot of anxiety about the idea of a full pullout in America. And they'd sort of mooted this idea, I think, to sort of frighten Karzai into signing it. And it sort of backfired a bit because he's saying, well, go on then. And so they're sort of having to pull back from that threat and delay and delay.
How much do you think this is the picture that we're hearing here is of a president who knows he's on his way out, who is really being the single block in so many things, for example, the security agreement with the United States, who is now choosing to look elsewhere, to look towards his neighbours such as Iran and India?
Yes, I think Karzai is certainly very aware of his legacy, that he's going to be leaving power in April, and I think he's quite conscious of how he's going to be remembered. There's already people who see him as a sort of Western stooge, as someone who is installed by the NATO forces occupying the country. And so I think he doesn't want to be seen as someone who sort of signed a death warrant for his country by allowing foreign forces to remain a decade after they were supposed to have left. So I think that's certainly coming into play here.
So he, as Emma says, been talking to the neighbours. He's already struck some kind of deal with Iran.
Yes, absolutely. So there was already a sort of broader cooperation and friendship agreement in place since August, and that's been sort of widened out on Sunday. And I think the timing is quite interesting. Iran is the only one of Afghanistan's regional neighbours which has encouraged it not to sign the US bilateral security agreement. Every other neighbour has particularly India actually has encouraged Karzai to do so. So I think the sort of timing of that may seem like a bit of a fingers up to the US and to the security agreement.
Nonetheless, relations between Afghanistan and Iran aren't always the best. You have a large number of Afghans living in Iran who are treated very, very badly. How is this going to go down with people in Afghanistan seeing Hamid Karzai moving towards a country that doesn't really like the people who live there very much?
Yeah, I think it's on this, as on so many other things, I think Afghanistan's really quite divided. And I think that's certainly true. But for every person who's sort of, I think, going to be worried about closer cooperation with Iran, there's going to be others who feel that continued presence of foreign forces, for instance, is going to encourage insurgency by preventing peace talks with the Taliban. They've already people expressing anxiety that continued presence of foreign troops will mean that there's not going to be peace. So I think for every person who thinks that, again, is sort of on the other side of it, there's someone who's going to think, well, hang on a minute, what if we don't want to return to civil war? What do the Iranians really want here? So I think it's a very divided population.
Well, where are we on talks with the Taliban?
Well, I think it's all quite stalled, really. And I think I was just reading a couple of days ago an interview with a Taliban commander who was saying that if the, you know, that this sort of means the end of all hopes for peace talks. I think that that's sort of perhaps slightly excessive, because the whole thinking behind peace talks is finding middle ground, I think, and the two sides in this thing between the Taliban and the current government, it's such a radically different starting point of their vision for the state that it's quite difficult to see where that middle ground could be found. But they've certainly said that if the US remains, there will be no peace talks.
Samira Shackle, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monaco
24。Oplondo, du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin and Emma Nelson. It's time now for us to get a check-in of some of the top stories out of South Korea.
Joining us now for more is Monocle's man in Seoul, Jason Strother. Jason, welcome as ever to the programme. Before we move to news coming out of South Korea, can we first have a look at the execution of Jang Song-taek, the uncle of Kim Jong-un up in North Korea? How have the South Korean media been taking this?
Well, the South Korean government has had an emergency session today. I mean, everyone is very curious about what are the actual reasons that Mr. Jong was put to death. Analysts here have all kind of shrugged their shoulders simultaneously. No one expected it to happen this quick, that a top official, perhaps the second most powerful man in North Korea, gets purged, goes to trial and then gets executed. One analyst here says that this is only a sign of more purges and other ousters of officials to come.
Jason, let's go on to the stories that you've chosen to have a look at today. The export of fighter jets to Iraq.
Right. See, this is South Korea is really trying to take itself now as a military exporter to what they've described as niche markets that are markets where other countries sometimes are a little hesitant to sell to, and markets that perhaps don't have the money to buy the really expensive stuff from European arms manufacturers or American arms manufacturers. So they're selling 24 fighter jets to Iraq. It's South Korea's biggest military export deal to date, $1.1 billion. And there's going to be more service deals to come after that. So I think this is a great moment for South Korea, who's been reaching out, especially to Southeast Asia already, to sell military equipment. But I think this, you know, I spoke to a representative of DAPA, the Defense Acquisitions Program Administration, the government agency that handles arms exports. They say they want to break into the top 10 of global arms dealers.
How likely is that, do you think?
It's going to be hard to compete with the already established nations that sell arms, the U.S., Russia, France, Britain. But I think if South Korea continues to hit these, you know, sell a lot of, let's say, cheaper material, you know, in big quantities. I mean, already they have a deal going on with Indonesia to sell jet training, air fighter jet trainers.
There's another deal in the works with the Philippines that's been put on hold temporarily because of the typhoon. If they can keep scoring deals like this, I don't know about top 10, but they'll definitely move up in the ranks.
I mean, the aircraft, it's an FA-50 light attacker. It beat off the UK's BAE Yakovlev from Russia and the Czech manufacturer, I think it's Aero Vodochody. This is clearly an indication that South Korea is carving a little niche for itself. I mean, you say it might not be the great player, but it's clearly making an impact in the likes of the Middle East with this deal with Iraq.
It definitely is, but I think their marketing might be misguided. I mean, there's always been this talk of the Korean discount, you know, that products from Korea aren't worth as much as, you know, products from other more developed countries. And I think the way the strategy that the arms exporters here are doing is trying to undercut the more established players in the trade, selling, you know, perhaps not as high-end products for, you know, a significantly lower price. I'm not sure if that's the way one really would want to make a name for themselves in the arms trade, but that's what South Korea seems to be doing.
Jason, let's go on to the gaming addiction. Lawmakers are looking into this.
Sure. I mean, if this law gets picked, there's two laws that parliamentarians are currently looking at. And if they're adapted, it would basically label online gaming as an addiction right alongside as alcohol or drugs or gambling. Of course, a lot of parent groups seem to be pleased with this, but the gaming industry here, which is a highly lucrative industry here, multi-billion-dollar industry, is not happy about it. If the laws if the legislation is passed, it would limit the amount of advertising gaming companies could do. It would also require them to donate some of their profits to a government fund to treat online gaming addiction. We'll have to see how the lawmakers decide on this.
It sounds, you know, quite tricky to enforce, I'd imagine, but there's a huge amount of encouragement given to internet entrepreneurs in South Korea. Yet to say we're going to outlaw certain areas of online gaming, that really does discourage them. Where does the government try and work this out?
Sure, right. I mean, I've seen statistics that in 2012, the online gaming industry was one of the most lucrative entertainment industries here, and way more successful than the money that Psy brought in with his with Gangnam Style. The government says around 2% of South Korean youth are addicted to games, so it is a fine line. Now, of course, the entertainment industry here doesn't have as much sway as, let's say, the automotive industry or some of the heavier industries here. But they could put substantial pressure on the Korean government to make sure that their bottom line isn't hurt.
Jason, technology. It's interesting to see now that Samsung hasn't won in its home court.
Right, absolutely. I mean, this basically, Samsung and Apple have fought battle after battle in courtrooms around the globe. On Thursday, here in Seoul, a district judge decided that basically threw out Samsung's claim that Apple infringed on three of its patents. The judge said that these are patents that easily could have been developed independently, one of which the judge didn't even think Apple even used in their smart device technology. So it was a big blow to Samsung.
It's a big blow in one way, but it's not really going to harm Samsung in the long term, is it?
Samsung is the world's leading smartphone maker. Apple, while cutting into its share here in South Korea and overseas, is considerable. Samsung still is way ahead of the game. But, you know, there's this notion that Apple is hip. It has that brand value that Samsung just hasn't really been able to get a hold of. And it's Apple that comes out with the new innovations, the new software, the new interesting software and apps, where Samsung is still, you know, playing catch up more or less. So, I mean, both sides are doing the same thing. They're using lawsuits to try to impede the other's progress.
And neither coming out looking very good either. Jason Strother, our man in Seoul, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
In the next half hour of the programme, it's cameras, lights, action as we head to Brisbane for the Asia Pacific Screen Awards. And we'll grab our baskets and forage for some food. The only difference, we're in our city's parks.
Here's the young burdock growing on the ground. The root is white inside. It's related to artichokes and smells and tastes like a combination of artichokes and potatoes.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. North Korea's state news agency says the uncle of the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, has been executed for corruption. Earlier this week, Chang Song-taik was removed from a Communist Party meeting. The KCNA agency says he was put on trial on Thursday and admitted trying to overthrow the state. He was executed immediately. A new report by UN investigators says chemical weapons were probably used at 5 out of 7 sites in Syria, but it doesn't reveal whether the government or rebels had used them. The leader of Ukraine's opposition Batkivshina party has called the government's promise to sign a deal with the European Union a bluff. On Thursday, the first deputy prime minister said Kiev would soon sign an agreement with the EU, but no date or deadline was given. The US House of Representatives has overwhelmingly passed a rare bipartisan budget plan that would end some automatic spending cuts on federal agencies, known as the sequester, and replace them with more targeted government savings. A new report by the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns says thousands of guns are being offered for sale illegally by unlicensed firearms dealers on a single website in the United States. The group estimates that nearly 250,000 guns would be advertised on the site in a year by high-volume sellers posing as private sellers who will not necessarily require a background check. Jewellery owned by the former British monarch Edward VIII and his American wife Wallis Simpson has sold at auction in London for just over £620,000, beating expectations. Those are the main stories, the headlines, rather, at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, the time here in London, 8:31. I'm Georgina Godwin and Emma Nelson is here too. Urban foraging, plucking wild edible plants and berries from local parks, has become an increasingly popular pastime in major cities in the United States.
For example, in New York, a city not afraid to take a risk with its food, one man has led decades of tours to teach foragers what to eat and what to let grow. As the winter set in, intrepid nature lovers go to Central Park for their last chance to collect urban edibles with him. Megan Dietrich grabbed her basket and headed off into the bushes.
All right, it is 2:37. We're going to get started. We don't have that much.
Clutching umbrellas and paper bags, around 30 people braved the drizzling weather on a Sunday afternoon to hunt for berries, walnuts, and edible roots off the footpaths of Central Park. Their guide, Wildman Steve Brill, has been leading foraging and ecology expeditions throughout New York for more than 30 years.
It's called sassafras. Simmer the root, you can use it over and over again. This is enough for a gallon and make a tea. If you chill the tea and add chilled sparkling water, if it's hot, it goes flat. Chilled sparkling water and a sweetener, you have root beer. Add a little of each into a bowl and stir so you can get just the right strength of sassafras, carbonated water, and sweetener.
Donning a safari hat, shovel, and hiking backpack. With glasses and a thick brown beard, Steve leads participants on a 4-hour tour of the free-range treats in New York's largest park.
I teach people to identify things correctly, what the important identifying characteristics are. So you can learn these things. You start with a few species that have no poisonous lookalikes, learn them well, follow them through the seasons, fool around with them in the kitchen, and then just go and expand.
People on today's tour are eager to dig in. It's late fall, but the park still has plenty to offer. Ginkgo nuts, black walnuts, dandelion leaves, and sassafras, which is used to make root beer.
Hey, Henry, can you peel one so we can try it?
Oh, yeah, I can do that.
From survivalists to young children, there's a growing interest in utilizing the free local edibles that grow in urban areas. Hobby botanist Steve Clavacci has brought his date to Central Park tonight. I met them shaking a persimmon tree.
You can't obtain the same flavors or culinary purposes that you can have from these wild plants. If you had an Asian persimmon from the store, it would not taste like an American persimmon. This, to me, is superior, or at least it's different, worth having. And because it's different, and it's only accessible in nature because it's not cultivated, you know, then that's the only way you can get it. It's kind of a combination between cinnamon, raw honey, unprocessed honey. It has that brown sugar taste.
Here's the young burdock growing on the ground. The root is white inside. It's related to artichokes and smells and tastes like a combination of artichokes and potatoes.
These days, it's easier than ever to find treats amongst the park greenery, especially with Steve's app, Wild Edibles, which allows foragers to identify over 150 tasty treats amongst the city's parks, along with suggested recipes.
Did you try my strawberry bitter dock leaves? There's a plant called bitter dock. It took me 29 years to appreciate it, and it is really, really bitter. However, when you cook it, it's something totally different. The bitterness all but vanishes, and the latest thing I did with them is roast them with some ground powdered freeze-dried strawberries seasoned with vanilla and orange rind. Stevia is the sweetener, and the base of the paste that I slathered them with is mellow miso and lecithin granules, and it works beautifully.
It's recipes like the strawberry burdock leaves that keep Steve coming back out to the parks.
There are all kinds of things you can do with wild foods. After 31 years of relentless experimentation, I come up with something new like this. I realize I barely scratched the surface of the possibilities.
This year alone, Steve has taken hundreds of people scavenging in Central Park. Winter is approaching and the tours will wrap up, but there's a whole new bounty of edibles to look forward to next spring. For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
Thanks, Megan. She was coming to us from New York there and talking to a man who puts lecithin granules in his dinner. You can hear the menu today at 1900 hours in London, 1400 hours in Miami to hear that piece again, and lots more.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at who the big winners are at this year's Asia Pacific Film Awards.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the culture section this month, we look at how Art Basel Miami has sparked a resurgence in the art scene in Colombia, Brazil, and Argentina. We put on our board shorts and head down to San Clemente in California, where an old-school magazine for the surf community is refusing to water down its offering for the digital age.
In the design section, we look to the future, meeting the heirs to the throne of design family businesses in Denmark, Bali, and Brazil. The CEOs of Artek and Todd's tell us about the year ahead. And then we visit the home of a South African national architectural icon as Cape Town celebrates its position as World Design Capital in 2014.
In the edit section, we take you on a shopping spree in Lisbon, visiting inspirational stores for Christmas gift giving. Plus, we publish our annual Travel Top 50, a roundup of the best planes, trains, hotels, restaurants, services, and special discoveries that have made our trips over the past 12 months more enjoyable.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now. In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week, in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Every 20 years, the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that gets rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. presented by me, Andrew Tuck. The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:39 here in London. The so-called Oscars of the Asian Pacific film industry happened overnight, but they weren't in Shanghai, Tokyo or Seoul. No, the ceremony was in the fairly unlikely city of Brisbane, Australia.
The ceremony was part of the Asia Pacific Screen Awards, and they've been attracting filmmakers from more than 70 countries to the northeastern city for 7 years. Monocle's Australia correspondent Adrian Craddock was there to see which countries won big. He joins us now where it's just coming up to about 6:40 in Brisbane, isn't it? It's time for a lovely Brisbane sundowner. What are they drinking at the Asia Pacific Screen Awards this year, Adrian?
Oh, there was plenty of champagne. Firstly, hello from Brisbane, the most humid city in Australia, it seems.
Welcome, Adrian.
But very, very glamorous indeed. In the wake of this award, I mean,
maybe just try and see how you reconcile humidity and glamour.
But when I first read about these awards, I thought a big Asian film award in Brisbane. You know, how good can this really be? But you know, being here on the red carpet, this is a real deal. I mean, it's a big event. You know, all these real movie stars from throughout Asia and even as far as like Middle East and Russia were here, and it was a real, you know, glamorous film award that you could expect from any world-class city.
And that makes it doubly unlikely that it's happening in Brisbane. Why Brisbane? Why is it hosting the ceremony for Asian film?
That sounds a little bit cruel, but I know what you mean. I mean, Brisbane, it doesn't have the strongest global reputation, but I think that's something that's changing. I mean, even just recently, before I got here, the big story in Australia is obviously the Ashes, so the English cricket team are here. And when the English cricket team visited Brisbane, Kevin Peterson, the captain of the English cricket team, said he'd rather watch paint dry than explore Brisbane. He said the city is only known by people inside of Australia. So, I think that those comments particularly hurt because the tagline of Brisbane at the moment is Australia's new world city. And they're doing everything. It's not just a slogan. They're doing everything they can to really establish that. Particularly the big one that's coming up is the G20,
yeah.
Which is next November, which will be, you know, probably the high point in this city's modern history, I think.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves with the G20, so let's concentrate on this high point, the Asia Pacific Screen Awards. Who were the big hitters who turned up?
Well, I mean, as I said, there were luminaries from countries far abroad. I mean, there were big Australian actors, obviously, people like Jack Thompson and David Wenham, who are real household names in Australia. But as well, I mean, there's a famous Indian director, Shyam Benegal, and you know, even the queen of Sri Lankan cinema, Melani Sirsenkar. So, you know, it wasn't just an Australian event by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, Australia did incredibly poorly in the actual awards. I mean, they did a great job of hosting, but in the awards, I think they had 4 nominations, but unfortunately, no cigar for the Australian nominees this time around.
So who were the big winners?
Well, the big winners were probably, I mean, one country that kind of jars when included in a region that's so-called the Asia Pacific is somewhere like Palestine. But somehow through, they base it on the UNESCO definition of the Asia Pacific, and Palestine actually scrapes in on that. And they did incredibly well. A Palestinian film called Omar won the best feature, and that's about two lovers trying to maintain a relationship on the West Bank and just the absurdities of everyday life on the West Bank. Also, India did quite well. A film called The Lunchbox won best screenplay and also won the Grand Jury Prize. It's a really cute kind of romantic film about a grieving widower who accidentally receives the wrong lunch from another man's wife, and a letter correspondence starts up between them. So it was great to see them take out a few awards. And I think that film really captured the imagination of the festival. But one of my favourites was a Singaporean film called Ilo Ilo by a guy called Anthony Chen, who was the director. He took out Best Director. And he had just won big at Cannes, and you know, it's quite telling that he, you know, even turned up. You know, he felt that these awards were so important that he had to be here, and I think it was great that he won as well. That film's actually about the 1997 Asian financial crisis and a Singaporean family and their relationship with a new Filipino maid. I really, really suggest all your listeners go and see it.
Now, there's also a documentary section.
Yeah, the best documentary was a film called The Act of Killing, which has got a lot of press worldwide. And it's mainly been done by a team of European filmmakers. But the reason it got into the APSAs was that it's actually co-directed by an anonymous Indonesian director, because the film is extremely sensitive. It's about the people who kind of carried out the death squads against the Chinese in mid-1960s Indonesia, and it's highly controversial. I mean, it depicts a lot of these people, and it actually asks them to act out how they kind of tortured and executed a lot of their victims. It's really, really groundbreaking documentary filmmaking. I've never seen anything like it before. But yeah, the producer who actually accepted the award dedicated it to this great host of anonymous Indonesian cast and crew who couldn't be there and couldn't even reveal who they were, really.
Adrian, you mentioned a few moments ago the forthcoming G20 summit. Some people, the anti-capitalist protesters, say they're going to cause chaos. But lots of urban planners say that Brisbane is going to have a bit of a spruce up and it's going to be ready. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, the city does seem like it's ready. I went to a press conference this morning with the Lord Mayor of Brisbane, a guy called Graham Quirk, and he seems extremely confident. I mean, a lot of the security is actually handled by the federal police. So I think security will be completely taken care of, and there are kind of designated places for protests to happen, and they've said that they'll have a zero tolerance approach to violent protests. So it seems like that will all be taken care of. As far as the city goes, I mean it's in good nick from what I can see. A lot of new hotels are popping up. I mean, some time ago the Brisbane Council actually offered a few incentives for hotel owners to start new ventures. So it seems like there's a lot of new accommodation in the city to host, you know, however many thousand delegates will be coming out here. So yeah, I mean, from what I've observed over the last few days being here in Brisbane, it is really developing into a world-class city, and it is developing into a place that is more than capable of holding an event like the G20.
Adrian, we'll let you disappear off into the Brisbane sunset for your sundowner. Thanks very much for talking to us, and we'll speak to you again very soon.
In just a moment, we flick through the front pages, but it's Friday, so let's play this. It's Katy Perry, Last Friday Night. Katy Perry there, talking about ménage à trois.
Good.
Speaking of which,
here's Tom Lewis.
I'm blushing, Georgina, even at the very thought.
It's easy to make you blush. You're looking fabulous in tweed.
Well, that's very kind of
you're
you.
You're embracing the winter
months. I knew
there
was a two of you, so I couldn't be sloppy this morning, I thought to myself.
And we're very glad to see it. He looks wonderful.
Spruce up, Mr. Lewis, kind. Looking sharp.
Again, I'm blushing, so there we are.
Brilliant. Right.
Tom is here for us to have a look through this morning's front pages.
Yes, I am. And I hope that I will not let you both down, because I hear it's been rather a vintage edition of the show this morning.
Does that just mean we're looking old?
Jeffrey Coffin, when he came into the studio this morning as we were just starting off, saying, you both look like you've just got up. I'm not quite sure what that was supposed to mean.
Shan't bother with the mascara this time, Jeffrey.
Getting up at 4 a.m. just to make yourself presentable.
Thomas, I'm resplendent in your mascara and tweed. You wanted to start with a really controversial thing that F.W. de Klerk has said with regards to the British approach to sanctions during the apartheid era. It is something that has come to bite the United Kingdom in the last week.
Well, it's been the key, maybe, topic of discussion, really, here in Parliament, but also kind of as the world reflects on Nelson Mandela. Each country has been looking at its role and its relationship with South Africa and with Mandela himself. And the key sort of maybe legacy, if we can put it that way, here in the UK is that Margaret Thatcher, who was Prime Minister until 1990, so before Nelson Mandela was released, was one of the key opponents internationally to imposing sanctions on the apartheid government in South Africa. Now, when parliamentarians on Monday here in London paid tribute to Nelson Mandela, a lot of politicians, especially on the Labour side, brought this up and said, actually, this is still a bit of a black mark on Britain's history. Now, in the Times today, former President F.W. de Klerk, who won the Nobel Peace Prize with Nelson Mandela 20 years ago, says that actually Margaret Thatcher was right in her stance, and that the Conservative Party, who are once again in power here in the UK, should really not have apologised for it. He goes into some quite great detail into the context of South Africa and to what was happening in the African continent more broadly, and he says that the timing getting rid of the apartheid regime in the early 1990s was actually the perfect time to do it, and any sooner really could have seen South Africa disintegrate into something pretty bloody and pretty awful. Now, Georgina, obviously you are more aware of Africa than anyone else here. I mean, what's your response to that statement?
I think it is really, really interesting. And as de Klerk points out, white South Africans had four major concerns at the time. How would they, and especially the Afrikaners, maintain their right to self-determination in a black majority government? I mean, that was a big, big thing. How are they going to keep all of that up? What assurances would there be for economic and political and cultural rights of minorities? And that's still a concern now. I mean, all these years later, how could whites be sure that the universal franchise wouldn't lead quickly into chaos and tyranny? Again, this is something that's being revisited now after Mandela's death. And finally, of course, there was communism, which led Reagan also to brand Mandela a terrorist. And of course, he only came off the US terrorist watch list in 2008. But if we look at what Mandela himself said about de Klerk, there's a wonderful quote from Helen Suzman, who was at a dinner party with Mandela. And she asked him about his view of de Klerk. And she says, everybody was anticipating strong criticism of him, and instead Mandela replied, my worst nightmare is that I wake up one morning and he is not there.
No, he was this great conciliator. Despite everything, he was the man who actually Mandela talked to. He was a man who had this conciliatory approach.
And would you say then, in this week of mourning, Georgina, that actually you look at kind of how we do remember, and actually a lot of the history has sort of become maybe a bit too easy, that we have forgotten actually the context of the time, and that it is easy to get outraged by things that on the surface do look pretty unacceptable, say in the global diplomacy world that we live in. But actually at the time, and having someone like F.W. de Klerk come out and say this, who is right in the thick of it, who himself basically brought the regime to an end, that he does remind us of the details of how complex that situation was.
Absolutely. And I think there's a danger of rewriting everything about Mandela as a hagiography. The man was no saint by his own admission. 156 counts of violence he pleaded guilty to. He was head of Umkhonto we Sizwe, which was Spear of the Nation, the so-called freedom fighter or terrorism group, depending on which side of the divide you sit. So, I mean, you know, I think there is a danger of rebranding him as this kind of cuddly person that we write a nice love song with a reggae beat to, as some of the papers have been saying.
You know, but I think he was straddling a really complex set of realities as
really,
much as anyone else.
He really was, and fighting for democracy, which he wonderfully achieved.
And it places people like the United Kingdom's David Cameron into an uncomfortable position now, because he has now said that the Thatcher government was wrong in its stance towards sanctions. It now finds itself having to be criticised perhaps for acting, for apologising too easily.
Indeed. Now, I would quite like, before we end, just to put a bit of a festive story.
We have 10 seconds.
We do. I'm going to go. So there's a small village in Cambridgeshire here in the UK.
It had better be good then.
That has created a human advent calendar.
How cool.
So a group of 23 houses and the village pub have joined forces, and every day these establishments have put something in their window. So at 6 p.m. every day, the villagers gather around the allotted house or the village pub, whichever it is on that day, and they open the window. There's a great reveal, and it's really bringing the community together, apparently, according to the artist who has established the thing. So festive cheer is sweeping the nation, as it should, I would have thought.
Have you been to Cambridgeshire recently?
Not recently, no.
That story explains many things.
Come on, there's festive cheer everywhere.
That's all we've got time for. Thanks very much to our producer, Phil Hahn, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and James McConkie, as well as our studio manager, Alex Funnell.
Up next after the news is Section D, Monocle 24's Design Hour. Your host for that will be our design editor, Tom Morris. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dared men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.